all right, we'll just go through this really fast.
Yeah, let's do it.
And then we'll talk.
I don't know that much about Islam, honestly, so bear with me.
Well, Islam, the word means submission in Arabic.
Wait, let me get my notebook out.
We even asked lots of questions then, which we won't know the answers to. And salam, means peace, but they both come from the same root word.
Islam, salam, and peace is related to submission, huh?
Evidently, because the root is the same. And, you know, it came about that the Quran itself is what Muhammad said was direct revelation to him. And as I say Muhammad, I'm going to just, when I spoke at the Islamic Sunday School, I talked to Greg beforehand, and I said, Greg, I don't want to do anything that's offensive. And he said, don't worry, they'll be very hospitable. But if you say Muhammad, Moses, or Jesus, say peace be upon him or peace be upon them. And I noticed when Obama spoke in Cairo, when he'd mention Muhammad, he'd always say peace be upon him. So evidently he had the same coaching idea. So the Quran is the direct revelation, and then there's another body of literature called the Hadith, H-A-D-I-T-H, and those are sayings of Muhammad. And some of the sayings are sayings of his wife and other people, but they aren't considered direct revelation. So that's the difference.
You said so. It's if it's Muhammad, Jesus, or Moses, you say peace be upon him.
Mm-hmm.
So they have as much respect for Jesus as Muhammad.
Yes, Jesus is a major prophet, but.
Not
the Son of God.
No. Mm-hmm.
Then the five pillars, they call them, are the profession of faith, and that there is no other God than God. And I got a good insight into that when I heard, I think he was a mullah speaking, an American. And he said, when I'm speaking Arabic, I say Allah. When I'm speaking English, I say God. And when I'm singing Latin, I say Deo. And he said, it's all the same.
Yeah, that's very helpful.
I thought it was. Uh-huh. Then the profession of faith, the ritual prayer.
Another way that I've heard it explained, and I've explained it to Christian groups, is they say, well, is Allah like their name for God? And I say no. It means God. The word means God. It's not their name for Him. It's the word Allah means God.
And in English, God.
It's like
in Latin, Deo.
Right.
That's very hard to try to make the fundamental Christians understand.
It's the same God as the God of Moses,
Abraham,
Isaac, Jesus.
It's just they so at least in my experience in Puerto mm-hmm. Rico, the fundamentalist Christians say no, Allah is a heathen God. It's not the same God.
Mm-hmm.
Even though, even
okay, so then ask them, who is Yahweh and who is Jehovah?
Yeah.
Who
are these people?
Yahweh, that would be a good one to add in there, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
And when I speak Swahili, I say Mungu.
In Kosi, in Siswati, it's all exactly. But they just are so hard-headed.
Yeah, they think, it's like, my friend Barb sometimes jokes that Jesus, Christ is what Jesus is. Christ is not Jesus' last name.
Right. Well, and the thing is, they say, well, take out a Bible, an Arabic Bible. What's the word in the Bible that they use for God? It's Allah. I remember.
But they think that you're just taking Allah and putting it in.
I know.
substituting.
Pardon.
I know, okay, but I interrupted.
No, no, that's what we're gonna do today.
I think it's a hard thing for Christians to get, that it's not another name for God, it is God.
Ritual prayer, 5 times a day. I don't know. The Muslims that I know, the morning at dawn and the evening prayer, but the other times of day, I don't know if that's used as much. I was telling them, and I'll tell you, Dennis, in Corfe, the evening prayer, when the muezzin at the mosque has the call for prayer, then the oldest boy in every family goes up to the rooftop and answers.
Oh.
And it just makes a chill run up and down your spine when you hear all this from all over the village. Greg was on Pakistani, or was it, well, anyway, he was on an airline in the Middle East once, and the pilot came over and said something, and Greg didn't understand it, but people started moving around, and he said, oh my goodness, he said, we're going to crash, prepare for a crash, and so he was getting prepared for a crash, and then he realized it was prayer time, and the pilot had announced which direction Mecca was, and all these men were getting down on the floor to have their prayer. Then the third pillar is the zakat, or the alms tax, and giving to the poor and needy is mandatory. When we lived in Africa, all the beggars would come to town on Fridays, the holy day, and they'd go around to the different stores and the bank and receive their alms. So, fasting during Ramadan, and it's Ramadan right now. Would you give your thing on the American Liberties, ALCU, that you said were with the school kids?
Oh, yeah, I'm not sure it's the ACLU, but...
I said ACLU.
I got an email, and I have to say I don't know the origin. You know, some of these emails you can track back a long ways and not figure out where they're from, but someone sent an email, or it was reported, that there were some school systems in the U.S. that were starting to discuss whether the Ramadan fasting constituted like child abuse. And so whether by, and, you know, observing the Ramadan fast, which is from sun up to sundown, I think you're supposed to only have water, is that right?
No, you're not even supposed to swallow your saliva.
Well, that would be pretty strict.
Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people drink water.
Yeah, I think a lot of people. I know people that drink water. This, it seems like almost another one of these ways to befuddle Americans about Islam. Because in practice, children, many people are exempt from fasting. And you can exempt yourself if you... if your children can be exempted, I mean, they can observe if they're particularly pious or from a very strict family, but according to Islam, they are not required to fast. And also other groups, pregnant women.
They're not supposed to fast.
Right, exactly. And other groups, menstruating women sometimes, or people who are sick, or the handicapped. I mean, there's lots of dispensation on the fasting thing. And I know I have a Pakistani friend who tries to observe the Ramadan fast, but she'll give herself a break if she's like in a bad mood. She'll say, because she knows her she's not in the right place. She's not spiritually, she could fast, but it wouldn't be like faithful because she's feeling crappy that day.
And the fast is to be a spiritual thing, not a physical thing.
Or if she has a cold or is under the weather, she might, and her mother will say, oh, don't fast today, you don't feel well. So there's lots of slack on it. So if you get this email, about whether children, Muslim children, are being abused through the school systems or something. Just try to clear that up.
And then the fifth pillar is the visit to Mecca, but I started because that's if you can do it. And if you have made the pilgrimage to Mecca, you can put Haji in your name. So the village headman in Corfe, where Greg was Haji Ali, and that meant he had gone to Mecca. And that was the only time he ever went out of the mountains there. And then just briefly, the Sunni and Shia, the two main divisions. When Muhammad, and to be proper, peace be upon him, when he died, there was dispute on who should be the next leader. The Shia said it should be in the family, and the Sunni chose someone from his followers, and that's where the division came from. A nephew became the leader for the Shia. And about 85% of the Muslims are Sunni. The Shia is about 15%, and there's actually three subsets. There's the seventh that has everyone had to be a leader, a descendant of the seventh, but the main subset of the Shia is the Ismaili. And at one time they were very, very, I would say violent in a lot of this converting by the sword, but now it's probably the mildest group and the most Western, and the Aga Khan is the leader of the Ismailis. And the Shia come mainly out of Iran, in that area. The Ismailis are mainly in Pakistan. There used to be a lot of them in East Africa, but at the time of independence, a lot of them moved to Britain. And the Sunni, probably the most conservative sect of the Sunni, are the Wahhabi, and they're the ones who are doing a lot of the militant madrasas, but there are also Wahhabi who are very, very peaceful people. Shia are mainly in Iran.
Yeah, there's some in Lebanon as well.
Mm-hmm. How about the African Muslims?
Most of them are Sunni, but there are some Shia there too.
Okay. The Shia are better known, well, the Shia in general and the Wahhabi among the Sunni are the most, how would you say it, like radical, most fervent. And the Shia, I read a book by a really fine writer named Robin Wright. It's an old book now, about the Shia, about Shia fundamentalism. I wish I could remember the name of that book. It's probably 15 years old now. But the Shia have a very, they're known for their very emotional, the Shia fundamentalists are very emotional. They have their various observances when they observe, for example, when their leader was murdered, I think.
Ashur, I think.
Yeah, and then they have these parades, they beat themselves with chains and so forth, and they're very demonstrative and very emotional, almost hysterical. But there's a sect, like a very fundamentalist sect of the Shia. And you don't find that kind of demonstration among the Sunni at all. But the Wahhabi, out of Saudi Arabia, is the most conservative, rigid of the Sunnis. And it's out of the Wahhabi that
these militant madrasas.
Yeah, you know.
I'm going to turn around and start looking at people.
What's his name? Osama bin Laden comes out of the Wahhabi. Well, his family isn't Wahhabi, but he adopted the Wahhabist view as a young man. So they're the most rigidly conservative of the Sunnis.
And the Shia in Baltistan, where Greg is building the schools, almost all of those people are Shia. Interesting, his staff is Shia, Sunni, and Ismaili. And the Sunni, they will tease the Shia during Ramadan because they won't listen to any music or have all these things in. But it's, well, if you have a good Catholic friend or a Baptist friend or a Lutheran friend, you know, that kind of good-natured banter that goes back and forth between them.
Like we used to, in high school, we used to tease the on Fridays and say, well, let's go for cheeseburgers tonight. All the Catholic kids, they eat fish.
The Shia coming out of Iran, that's also where the whirling dervishes and the mystic come out of that. Also Rumi and Omar Khayyam. And language and poetry has always been huge with the Shia.
It's a little bit like the Sad Danes and the Happy Danes. The Shia, you know, have the beautiful culture and the, you know, that give us like Rumi, and they also have the most difficult, kind of violent types. Depends on which, where you're at, where you are. It's such a big Muslim world.
Now, is this visit to Mecca, is that one particular season of the year or one time of the year?
Well, a lot of them like.
That continues?
A lot of them like to make it during Ramadan, but it's continuous. But the huge crowds.
Yeah, I see those pictures of them.
Or the Shia may go on one of their, the Shia have more shrines and saints and more holy places. And they also, all Muslims hold Jesus very high, but the Shia even more so.
Right. Well, we had run into that. We toured Turkey and Istanbul in particular. One day we had a, I'm just relating this part of history. One day we had a Muslim woman as a courier in the bus, of course. And the next day we had a Christian young man who did an excellent job of telling the history of the Christian story. Looking at that woman, you'd never know she was Muslim because she had no religion. She had a very Western dress. Istanbul is very Western. You never realize that you were in a Islam or Muslim country. Because it's very modern, and the dress shops and everything are, you know, very Western. You never know it. But she related to that too, that she knew everything, just about everything about Muslim, but very up to date on the Christian. And he's talking about Mary and Jesus being a prophet that they knew, very much about.
And I've talked before. Mary is mentioned more often in the Quran than in the Bible. And Maryam is such a common name in the Islamic world.
Turkey is, as nations go, Turkey has, for how many years now, they've really focused on having a faithful, but a secular state where it's the only place kind of where...
Since Ataturk.
Ataturk. They try to kind of separate church and state a little bit.
Right.
And have a secular government, secular society, but one that, is righteous. And because everyone is Muslim, just about in...
Right. And there's...
There are Christians in Turkey, of course, too. But
they're still very protective of the Muslim religion because, I don't know, it was just a couple of days or afterwards that three women went out witnessing Christian Whitson down the street. They were arrested, and I don't know what happened. I think they were
in Turkey.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's
against the law to proselytize anything in Turkey.
Right.
You can't
be a Muslim.
You can't be a Muslim to proselytize on the street in Turkey.
And as far as the Western dress and things, I said before that it really doesn't say anything except to be modest. But then other people interpret, that only your face and hands should be showing, and that you see mainly in Saudi Arabia. I think that might have come about out of desert people. It isn't a good idea to be really a lot of your body exposed in a desert climate. It's better to cover up, but it's a guess.
But in Turkey, we saw very few women with covered heads.
Mm-hmm.
But she would just mention too that there's a lot of difference in the culture of Eastern and Western Turkey. Now, I haven't traveled in Western Turkey, but Eastern Turkey is very much liberal and very, but she was telling too that there has been convention or a group that come in from Eastern Turkey, and she couldn't get over that the women were still wearing their burqas,
mm-hmm.
their full heads, just the eyes open up so you can see. She just couldn't get over that. This hadn't changed.
Benazir Bhutto, who was Prime Minister in Pakistan and the one that was just recently assassinated, when she became of age, her mother was Shia and her father was Sunni. And when she became of age, her mother had her start wearing burqa, and they were hot and uncomfortable. And she said she didn't want to, and her father said she didn't have to. So she stopped wearing the burqa, and then her mother stopped wearing the burqa also.
Okay.
So, but it was in a society that allowed for that.
It's a society thing more than anything else, I guess.
So much of what we look at as Islam is culture.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And power.
There's a book about that. We put out as many library books as we could find on Islam, and one of them is about, it's that one there, I think.
This one?
No, Beyond. But with the color.
Ridges?
Yeah, I think that one has the.
A Christian perspective on folk Islam.
So this is about. I haven't read this book. I just glanced at it, but it does address the cultural things that aren't really in the Quran. They're not really part of Islamic orthodoxy, but they're things that Muslims do that are things that ways that different ethnic cultures manifest. I was going to point out that Ramadan is the doesn't it celebrate the giving of the text to Muhammad?
The revelation.
Yeah,
Muhammad.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's important. One of their most important observations. And I was in Cairo during Ramadan some years ago, which was very, very interesting. I was in Cairo for about 3 weeks, and most of that was during Ramadan. There were a couple of memories I had. One was that the city, lots of things you couldn't get done because, I had to go and get it's some paperwork, I can't remember, but I had to go to some office and get taken care of, and I must have gone to that office 3 or 4 times trying to find somebody there because they just said, well, it's Ramadan, a lot of people come in late. They come to work late on that during Ramadan. So we're not open yet, or we're open but nobody's there, and it was all just because of Ramadan. And then there would be a long period in the afternoon when shops weren't open. Everything was closed because people are fasting. They need to lie down. They need to rest, and it's hot anyway. And so there's sort of like a license given to people to take off from work to go home and lie down because they're fasting. And then, but boy, when the sun goes down, the lights come up, and it was so fun and exciting. Every restaurant was open. People were pouring out of their homes, going out to eat. Then the people would be sitting in their doorway with food, and their friends would come in, and everybody mill around in the front, in the entryway of the house, and they put tables out and chairs out in the front, in the front of their houses, and eat food, and it was really jolly. As soon as the sun went down, it was very, very, and then all the shops would open, and you'd see people going up and down, going into shops that, you know, sold clothing and gifts and whatever, because it's after sundown, everything comes to life. That was really interesting to me. And then there was a big, in Cairo every year, there's a big book fair during one of the weeks of Ramadan, and I was with some Christian Lutheran missionaries who wanted to go to that. They were both busy studying their Arabic in Cairo, so they wanted to go and find some books. And they had big tents set up, again, after dark. They had great big tents set up, and all the tents, they had entertainers, like Las Vegas style. And there, you know, there was, I mean, it was all in Arabic, but, you know, lots of color, lights, flashy costumes, lots of, it was like kind of the state fair, and very colorful and lively. And then out, so there's a bunch of tents with all this entertainment, and then in kind of the other area were just table after table after table. There must have been hundreds of tables just loaded with books. And every book dealer in Cairo was there trying to unload their extra inventory or sell things on sale. According to the missionaries, this was a great time to buy Arabic books cheaper because of the book fair. And then also they'd have all their new books. And then sale, lots of books on sale. And that was very unique. I felt like not too many girls from Minnesota get that experience because of the Ramadan book fair in Cairo. And I did find a book in English, so I was able to buy my souvenir.
Yeah, much of the
You find out anything different about Cairo, Istanbul? You've never seen anybody panhandling? Never. I never saw panhandling.
They don't have to because
they're taking care of them.
On Fridays, they just go to the places and just get their money. They don't have to beg. The businesses and things need to. I was going to say, Greg never stays in Pakistan or Afghanistan during Ramadan because it should be a very peaceful time, but there's a lot of extra violence there. I don't know if people feel during the fast time, I don't know. Stress.
That's interesting.
Stress.
You think it would be the opposite.
Yeah, you'd think it would be very peaceful, but, and you can't get much business done either.
Right, you can't get much work done.
Right.
Not much goes on then.
Now, this thing after sundown, they do that every day?
During Ramadan.
Yeah,
every
during
day
Ramadan.
After,
pretty much every day, except maybe it's different on Fridays.
Yeah, maybe.
Fridays, everybody goes to worship.
Now, how long does Ramadan last?
A month.
28 days.
Okay.
Some
4 weeks.
When there is no moon till new moon.
No moon to new moon.
Yeah.
And that's 28 days roughly. And you do need to sight the moon to break the Ramadan. So if it's cloudy, they take airplanes up now.
What?
So they get above the moon. And then they'll say there's been a moon sighting. So.
Now, what about children who are in dominantly Christian cultures? Does it affect them at all?
I don't think so. In fact, in Egypt, there are things that the Coptic Christians do during Ramadan, during the daytime, that the Muslims who are fasting, so they appreciate having the Coptic Christians.
Okay, help out. Yeah, okay. But what about the other way around? I'm asking about American Muslims. If they're going to school in America, do they have to alter their...
Children don't have to fast to start with. Some of them do, some of them choose to. And the schools I know will accommodate that. You don't have to go with your class and sit in the lunchroom if you're choosing to fast.
Okay.
That.
And then what do the observers of Ramadan do all day while they're fasting?
They work.
They do their same jobs.
They do.
Well, yeah, sort of. We just missed this discussion. They work, but they also take time off to go home and sleep and rest. Not so much sleep, but rest, because they're not eating.
But I mean, so the reason I asked was because you said they don't get much done.
Right.
So if they were...
Because they're not working. I mean it's like I explained.
At the same level.
You can go to the office, but there won't be as many people there to help you. Like this author says, let's see. Oh, I just thought. Anyway. Many a Western businessman has learned the hard way that Ramadan is the wrong time to travel to Kuwait or Libya. And he means generally Arab states, I think, or Muslim states. Not only are work hours shortened, but influential officials with authority make decisions, often leave for Europe. So
I have a good Egyptian friend, and he usually doesn't fast, but his brother recently died, so he is fasting this year. And one of the interesting things I learned about Islam that I didn't know is he talked about the washing of his brother's body after he died, and there's a special place in the mosque where you go with the body, and then the family washes the body. And they wanted him to be buried in the Twin Cities in the same cemetery as the sister in the family, and they were told there were no spaces, but they knew there was one, because when his sister got breast cancer, she bought two spaces, and her husband was so angry with her that she was supposing he would die too just because she did, he didn't get buried beside his wife. So they were able to bury the brother by his sister. But now there is no more land in that cemetery, and he said the Islamic community in the Twin Cities is having a very hard time being able to buy land for an Islamic cemetery.
Oh my goodness.
Even though there is land available.
Does the cemetery have to be Islamic? I mean, a lot of cemeteries are just commercial.
It could be, but... it's an Islamic cemetery if you're observant.
Oh, yeah, so it would be a preference.
It would be a preference, yes. And they want to have another one, but they're having trouble.
Well, the Jews have their own cemetery in the Twin Cities.
Well, they have a stronger lobby.
And Christians do, too. But there's also, like, the one by Lake Harriet, that's not a religious cemetery.
This is an aside, but I've got a good friend whose father is buried in Wisconsin in the Indian Cemetery, because the cemetery is there, but the Indian Cemetery, not Indian, American Indian, they couldn't be buried in the regular cemetery, so they're in the adjacent. I want to switch gears here because I just learned something that was very interesting to me in a book that talks about the colonial Americans' ideas of Islam. And something I had never thought of before, they said they would have had a very good source because so many of the slaves were Muslims coming from that west coast of Africa. So they had a double reason for enslaving them, because they were Muslim and because they were black, which I thought was very interesting. And I also heard on one where they said the blues, much of that has come from Islam, and they were playing different calls to prayer and repeating it in blues. So much of that music, although the Islamic culture died at that time within the population, but maybe there was something in the DNA or something when the black Muslim became popular. But this, and it made sense to me when I heard the different pieces of music. music played that the blues grew out of.
Did you notice in the film that we watched last week or earlier this week, the Arab musicians were playing, the one person on the violin, they were playing a very kind of Arab sounding motif, and everyone was kind of jamming on that that kind of Arab music. And as I was listening to it, it almost started to become like a Yiddish sounding. So I thought, yeah, they are related.
The same.
They are related. They use those minor tones and those interesting combinations of notes. It sounded starting to sound like what are those bands called?
Klezmer
band almost. And there's a very fine line really between Arabic music and klezmer music.
I would like to ask a question about the growth of Islam worldwide and how did it happen. I took a class in 1965 at the University of Minnesota on the Islamic world and was told it was the fastest growing world religion and that the major key to this was that they had one of the main pillars was generosity and care of the poor. So it appealed to poverty-stricken populations, of which there were so many around the world.
I think family size has a lot to do with it, too. That's one reason why the Lutheran Church in Tanzania is growing so much faster than the Lutheran Church here, is because they have bigger families.
I see. So it's kind of like the Roman Catholics.
In Jerusalem, what is it they say, within 15 years or 20 years, there'll be more Arabs in Jerusalem than Jews because the Palestinians who live in Jerusalem have so much larger families than the Israelis do.
I don't remember the statistic, but they're gaining on them pretty fast.
Mm-hmm. And are the Palestinians Arabs? That's another question.
Yes.
They are definitely Arabs. Because that, you probably already made that distinction.
But
we haven't really been talking about Palestinians, but we
talked about
there's Muslims. This is a point that we talked about at breakfast. There are Muslims who are Arabs, and there are Muslims who are Persians, and there are Muslims who are the people, the hill tribes, hill people of Afghanistan. Not everyone who's a Muslim is an Arab.
In fact, Arabs are quite the minority.
And not everyone who's an Arab is a Muslim.
Because there are Asians that are
Christian Arabs.
Southeast Asians are
the largest.
The largest Muslim state is Indonesia.
Yeah.
I highly recommend, again, the book that's in the bookstore, The Faith Club. And that is brought out in that book, what you're just asking now. A Jewish young lady, a Muslim young lady, and a Christian young lady outside of New York City decided they wanted to write a book for their children about their faiths. But as a result, they met regularly and established rapport with each other took a lot of time for that. And the next thing they knew, they ended up writing a book, this Faith Club, which describes each of them and how they feel towards meeting another person. And what you just asked, that question is addressed in the variety of different Faith Club.
And engaging the Muslim world by Juan Cole is just an excellent book. I think it was Bill Moyers that I saw interviewing him, and he said, how is it what you are saying is so different from what we're hearing from our press and our government? He said, because I live there. But that's an excellent book. And one of the things I wanted to bring out that I learned is the whole role of women. The Quran was the first place that I know of where it is written, women shall inherit. In the Jewish world, in the early Christian world, women had no rights of inheritance. And we often, at least I thought, Sharia law was so terrible in Islamic court. If a woman goes to an Islamic court, she will inherit her husband's. That will be hers. It won't belong to her husband's brothers. In Pakistan and Afghanistan, the largest tribe is the Pashtun, and they're in Pakistan too. When the British drew the line, they drew it right through the middle of this tribe. And there, the women didn't have right of inheritance.
That's the same with Christians and Jews in the early church, because the Gentile Christian women could inherit. So if they're from Greece and the Romans or all that, but the Jewish, it was the Jewish cultural stuff that disallowed that, not the rest of the Christian world. So,
but with the Greek women, it's kind of interesting. When I was in Greece, I was with two American women from Detroit who were going to Sparta because the Athenian women could not inherit, but the Spartan women could, and they still do, but can't take the money out of Greece. So they were buying gold and fur coats and all of that.
Wow, it's even now.
Well, I've talked about before this whole thing of ikra and seeking knowledge, and women are supposed to, so it's cultural, the other.
Yeah, I just read the A Thousand Splendid Sons, and that is that's a really sad picture of the state of women under the warlords, under the Taliban, under the rule of the culture. So I don't know. I can only hope for a better outcome for women in Afghanistan.
I think it happened with schooling, and it's amazing what some of the educated women there are doing. The first time Greg was in Afghanistan, and that was soon after the Taliban had been defeated, he went to the medical school. And there were quite a few women there, but what I wanted to say, there were 10 stethoscopes.
Oh.
That was what was left for the whole medical school. What else did we learn?
What's the relationship of the drug trade to the Islamic community?
You're not supposed to use drugs. The drug trade has, it's all tied up with the Russian mafia, and the Chechens are the ones who are making the most money from it.
But do they have any influence that pushes back on the raising of opium and selling of it?
If your fields have been mined, your apricot trees and grapevines have been cut down, and you have a family to feed, and you can get enough money that your family will get food with the opium, you probably grow it. This again is Greg's solution. He said it's necessary for the medical industry, and if farmers would get a fair, like our fair trade coffee and tea, price for their opium, each farmer could have just a little plot, grow that, sell it legally, get the right price from it, and that's his solution. But he didn't think it will happen, but he thinks it would work.
Interesting. Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like prohibition, you know, that got all criminal.
Yeah. Well, if we legalized drugs in our country, it would put the kibosh on that. Don't you think?
Yes, some, but then the farmers wouldn't get anything for it. Because the Chechens would find out something different. It's not an easy solution.
But if it were legalized, wouldn't there be more regulation of the way in which it was traded, and couldn't there be a favored nation status, for example, for
maybe
for, I mean, we have that in other markets.
Maybe.
Well, opium was grown there before the Russian mafia came in. I mean, opium has been grown many countries.
Isn't that where the Wizard of Oz is?
Certainly grown in Laos and Thailand and a lot of places where opium is grown. It's not, I think we put a lot of children on the people that grow opium when actually it's a supply and demand. If people weren't using drugs, there wouldn't be a demand for opium. So.
And it's a one-year crop to replant your apricot trees and your grapevines and things. You're going to have to wait quite a while. But that is happening. But it's because the Russians, one of the reasons they cut down the orchards is because the insurgents hid in the orchards. So they cut them all down.
Yeah, that sounds familiar.
And during the Russian times, women had lots of rights in Afghanistan. They were trying to impose the same thing that there was in Russia.
That comes out in 1,000 Splendid Suns. Women had a kind of a renaissance under the Russian domination.
When Greg has spoken to women, the business of wearing the burqa or the chador is so far down their list of things. I think I mentioned it once, when he asks the women what they most want, number one, that their babies won't die, and number two, that their girls can go to school. Or their boys, if there's no school available for the boys. And then another thing I wanted to say, the people of the book. The people of the book are supposed to be honored in Islam. And that's the Jews, the Christians, and the Muslims, because they all have that book, the Kitab. And Greg has found no adversity toward him because he's a Christian. And they'll say he's a person of the Kitab, a person of the book.
Hmm.
Yeah.
I was interested in what you said about Greg's thoughts about the Afghanistan policy, the American military in Afghanistan, particularly because President Obama is getting increasing pressure from his own party on the Afghan policy. And so I was just interested in hearing more about what you...
Yeah. Well, Greg's not in favor of increasing the troops at all.
Okay. Right.
He doesn't, but he at the same time feels that our armed forces are way ahead of the State Department. Maybe because more people from the armed forces come to talk to him. But he said when he first was in Afghanistan and would go to where troops were based, it would be, okay, we have this many men and this many jeeps and this many tanks, and here's the hierarchy. He says when you go now, he sees three of them. That's still there. But they will have the government hierarchy and then the local. Who are the elders? Who are the... and that's another interesting thing. There is a big schism,
class difference,
between the elders and the Taliban, where traditionally the elders have always been the top, and the young Taliban are trying to usurp them. And if you look at violent societies, the more youthful the society is, the more violent it is. Societies such as Japan now, which is really aging. Japan is a very peace-dominated. When I was there, I did see demonstrations in the streets, and it was teachers demonstrating for peace. That, but the higher the percentage of young men and the younger the society is, the more violent they are. I don't know, does that answer you at all, Mary?
That's Carol.
I didn't mean Mary, I meant Carol.
That's okay. She's
I think that it's you know, as people who want to be politically informed, et cetera, and want to know
mistake. For one thing, the Pashtun, there are five major families or five major groups. And historically, forever, they have always fought among themselves, except when they have a common enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, we're really furnishing that for them.
It's hard to know how much military presence is helpful in, or if any of it is. I mean, it's pretty obvious that without any Americans in Afghanistan, the Taliban would take over, right?
Not necessarily. If there was no American or coalition armed forces there, I don't know that the Taliban would take over.
Well, what would be another scenario that you could describe?
Sending in people, not to tell them what to do, but how can we help you? And I think that's true in West Bank and Gaza, too.
Yeah,
should be asking, how can we help you?
Yeah, 2 points in that. What Greg has found in his relationship with the military is increasingly their role there is to be a resource to the people. At bottom line is, we've got to get these people to like us. if they don't like us, why will they be on our side against anybody? And we can't. And it's never worked in Afghanistan to divide and conquer. Which is usually the technique we use: find some group, make them our pals, divide.
And it always backfires.
But the thing that I think is really hurting us in the Pashtun area is the use of these drones. And so if sending in more personnel, if they come with, you know, shovels and you know, school kids, great. Armed, I don't know. But these drones, these computer-driven missiles that they're shooting from New Mexico, you know, it's like a computer game. This is not winning us friends.
Plus, it's not an honorable way of doing it.
It's not at all honorable.
And honorable is very important there.
Yeah. I just want to say before we close on this, this is from Iran and Iowa, not from Afghanistan, but I formed a correspondence friendship with Catherine Cove, who was one of the hostages in Iran many years ago. And she teaches off and on at Wartburg College in Iowa. I gave the person to try to get up here. But she was a cultural attaché in Tehran back when she was taken hostage. And she still holds to the idea of cultural exchange and meeting people at the level of poetry that they love so much, and drama,
everyone,
and dance, and art, and song, instead of...
everyone in Iran is a poet.
Right. Mm-hmm. They love the arts all through the Muslim world.
One other thing that Greg really believes, he said after World War II, the glory of the Marshall Plan was it was decentralized. It was local. The money and things didn't go to the central government. All of our aid in Afghanistan and Pakistan is centralized.
With Iraq.
And he said he believes that they would decentralize it, in Afghanistan especially, because in the first place it isn't a country. But historically, they've always had all these groups. They've always got along really quite well. There was a vibrant Jewish community at one time. Now it's down to, what, 3 or 4 men? Christians and Sunnis and Persians and Pashtun, and they've always kind of got along. But he believes decentralizing would make a big difference.
And increasing the economic and social aid to...
Yeah, I think so. I don't know. I hope Greg does. But I think you have to expect a certain amount of loss. You got to trust people in a decentralized arrangement. You got to trust people, trust elders, trust groups, and you might take some losses.
And he says the big thing he believes is compassion and love. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of difficult if your training has been to kill, which is what armed forces are.
They're warriors.
They're warriors to have compassion.
It's really hard to go in and try to say, I want to be your friend, while the drones are
already destroyed their schools and their hospitals and their roads. Now we want to be your friend. I mean, we destroyed everything, and now we want to be your friend.
Right,
okay,
yeah.
Well, we'll think about that.
Like, oh, yeah. Great.
So but on compassion and love, I think